a lot of the times people's stories were telling me about how they built a sense of themselves in place and how places really contributed not just to their dialogue with others, but really their sense of ethics, their sense of themselves.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, an architect by profession, the executive director of At Home with Growing Older, and the producer of this podcast. In our interviews, we explore the meaning of being at home with growing older from two angles: how we can adapt our living spaces to better support as we age, and how we can cultivate a sense of belonging within our communities and ourselves. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, medicine, social services, and beyond, and through the interesting comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you. Our guest in this episode is urbanist, photographer, and author Gabriel Bendinaviani. Welcome, Gabriel. Gabriel has developed a distinctive approach to understanding what cities' real people need. For the past 20 years, she asked residents to guide her through their neighborhoods, revealing the spots that hold meaning for them. Places like a beloved donut shop, a quiet corner in a park, or even just a basketball hoop. Through her beautiful photography, writing, and this immersive process, Gabrielle reminds us that our connections to these places matter deeply for our health and well-being, an insight also of great benefit for city planners and developers. Congratulations, Gabrielle, on your new book, which was just released at the end of August. It's called The Cities We Need, Essential Stories About Everyday Places.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we jump into our conversation, a reminder, let others know about these opportunities and share it. Gabrielle, I would like to ask you to start these conversations by reading a passage from your new book.
I'd be happy to. One of the things this book is about is walking and movement through place. So I just want to read a little bit. How our bodies are allowed to move through everyday spaces significantly contributes to whether we feel our lives are precious. How places enable physical freedom is one part of how they do the place work of supporting ourselves. Freedom is both in our bodies and our minds.
This quote really drives home the significance of the quality of the urban space on how it impacts our health and well-being, especially as our bodies change and our abilities. Can you please talk a little bit more about this notion of freedom and the concept of placework?
Absolutely. I'll talk a little bit about the idea of placework. In doing this work, I had originally asked people to take me on tours of their neighborhoods. I was very interested in what was important to people in their everyday places. But I don't know that I knew exactly what I was going to find by doing that. I'm also just very curious about people. And one of the things that I started to see when people would talk to me about the place and take me to these places that were important to them was most of the time they weren't very capital I important places. They were very banal places usually that people took me to. But as I walked with them and I listened to the interviews over and over and over again, one of the things that really stood out was what people were telling me was that this place does a certain thing for me. It contributes to my life and it contributes to my capacity to kind of be in the world. And I started to think about that you know, connected to ideas of social capital, connected to ideas about third places or all these other ways of thinking about social infrastructure and all the pieces of physical places and the way people fit together with them. But what I started to focus on was what the places were doing for people. And I saw place work being this idea that places do something very important for us. They work for us. A lot of the times people's stories were telling me about how they built a sense of themselves in place and how places really contributed not just to their dialogue with others, but really their sense of ethics, their sense of themselves. And I think that's where this idea of where they felt free and where they felt like they could be themselves came from. My background is also as an environmental psychologist, which it's taking a social science approach to people's relationship to place. And in particular, thinking about it both from the lived experience of individuals in place, as well as also looking at other scales. But that idea of saying, well, what does it look like when we think about large societies and the way it relates to place and what these small everyday places can do, but also what does it do for the individual in our shaping of our own experiences and who we are in the world? Two sort of big things came forward in thinking about that piece. When people talked about how these places really helped them be themselves, people told me that their sense of ethics, you know, kind of how you're supposed to be with other people, how you're supposed to behave in the world, was really, maybe if not determined by these places, but very much solidified by them. And having those ethics reinforced in place was so important to them. And then another big chunk of that sort of sense of how I feel like I can be myself, the work that these places do for me, was where I feel free. And that was really an intersection between physically feeling free, like I can physically move through this space and I feel unencumbered, but also I feel welcome and I feel that I am allowed to be in this space. I'm not questioned and I feel like I belong here. And so that intersection around freedom really seems so important and seems such a central piece of the work, especially in the context of there's a whole lot of history about how people's bodies have not been free in most of our cities for a pretty long time.
Yeah, and it seems also that people would take responsibility for these places they felt free in, no?
Yeah, that extended really simple things too. A teenager telling me where he felt like he was free to play handball, to play with his friends, that whatever he was doing was an acceptable thing to be doing in that space, that loud play was fine, that he could feel like a champion in this place. And that really built his sense of self and sense of freedom to be himself in lots of different ways. So even in these quite everyday things, people were talking about something that's actually a really, really important and huge feeling that builds our capacity to go out into the world, to do all the possible things that we can do as individuals.
Over the last 20 years, you focused on two neighborhoods, the Mosswood neighborhood in Oakland and Prospect Heights in New York. Did you intentionally choose these neighborhoods, or were these neighborhoods where you lived?
They are neighborhoods I lived in. When I started, I just was very curious about where I was. And I had been doing this work of asking people for tours in other places for quite a long time already, but I hadn't yet done it in a neighborhood that I actually lived in. I'd done it in places that I worked in or was very familiar with, but not in a place that was right outside my door. I actually started it almost immediately after 9/11 at a time when it seemed really, really important to know my neighbors and know my neighborhood. I'm a New Yorker and it seemed very important to do something that was about care for my city and caring about the small everyday things that we could actually protect and lean on each other for. So it started in that way. And then the work in Oakland, I did also live there. I had thought, well, could this be an interesting comparison? And I didn't know. By that time, I kind of knew what the work was that I wanted to keep doing, partially in understanding some of the parallel histories of the two neighborhoods, which look very, very different, but in some ways are really marked by the same kinds of post-war urbanism and really big urban shifts, both in labor and in redlining, all the many things that shape American post-war urbanism, had impacted both of these really small neighborhoods that were also kind of in between sorts of neighborhoods in pretty interesting and some parallel ways. And that made me think that people's everyday experiences of these two places might make sense as a comparison.
One of the things you said in your book really struck me. I'm curious also how this related to these two neighborhoods. Your notion that people should have the right to walk and should have the right to walk with joy in their neighborhood. And this is not always possible. You know, people of color might have the feeling that they are a threat to others, or older adults might feel very frail and not safe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about this right to walk, which I think is a very powerful call to action. We all have a right to walk with joy.
Yeah, as you say, Susie, walks are not an easy thing for everybody. That's actually one of the things that's very problematic about a lot of the literature about walking and walking in cities. It tends to be a lot of old white French men who were like drunk and wandering the city. And like, that's what we draw on for so much of our thinking about walking and the romanticism of walking in the city. And I'm not interested in that. And I'm really interested in, you know, the vast majority of people's experiences of walking in the city, which is nothing like that, but is still very, very powerful. And so there's just a little snippet here. Walks are like everyday places, not things that are nice to have, but things to value, that hold power, that are unequally safe, and that are vital to understanding experience. Because walking is close to my heart as a way of understanding and knowing places, and to really know a place feels like a necessity to have an embodied experience of that place. It was important to understand that idea of, could I ask people to walk with me? And by doing so, understand what their experience of walking was. By putting myself in their places and even just trying to match their gait and where they were and how they felt and where they didn't go and where they did go, maybe that would help kind of unpack and uncover some of the politics of walking as well. And a lot of people talked about that as we walked. Some people said, well, you couldn't go here by yourself, you know, or, oh, I'm probably walking slower than you would by yourself, or lots of things like that. And people were quite conscious of it. Sometimes it had to do with age. It had to do with ability or disability. Sometimes it had to do with race. Sometimes it had to do with people's sense of familiarity with the place. All of those pieces really came into play. And I think that idea of this right to walk really became so central to the book as well, as being really quite important. I will also go on drives with people, and not as a replacement for walking, but some people have a very physical and embodied experience of driving and a lot of emotion attached to that. And that movement through space can be very important as well, and can even involve like bumping into people or kind of chatting out the window. People said, like, I'd love to walk over there with you, but my legs just won't make it. So we're going to have to drive. And I hope that's okay. Or that would be nice, but we're not going to take that route. All of the pieces that were part of considering how to shape the walks or how to shape the drives were quite important. And you could really see in lots of people's conversation how much they had to shift or maneuver or manipulate the way that they could get around the city. And that had lots to do with both physical comfort and what does it feel like to be whoever you are in this culture at that time.
And of course, our cities should strive to enable us in this way as much as possible. I mean, a broken sidewalk can keep somebody from walking.
Or where people feel like there's nothing close enough to my house that I can walk to, right? That idea that that's not possible also came up. That can be in and of itself very isolating.
Social isolation is a real health crisis. It's odd to have to say this, but it is a health crisis in the United States. Everyday places which bring people together in a casual way and walking are ways for people to connect without planning. I love the way you talked about what you called enduring and casual talk. dialogue and banter, sort of variation of connecting. Can you say a little bit more what you observed?
One piece of very important work, helping us figure out how to be ourselves. Like, how do you be a good person in the world? How do you feel a comfortable person and a happy person because you're able to be safe and be welcome and feel like you belong, right? So there's that one piece we saw happening in these very everyday places. But at the same time, I also saw them facilitating people's capacity to be in community with other people. That's a huge part of what a lot of these everyday places did for people. So that idea of the formation of self, but also the formation of your capacity to be with other people. One of the things that seemed really important about being with other people or being with strangers is places that facilitated two different kinds of talk. One of them being just the very like casual banter. Some of my tour guides described it as talking trash. When I was in the Bay Area a couple of weeks ago, somebody actually was like, but what about the A's leaving? And I was like, see, there's another opportunity for talking trash right there. And people, the spaces in which you basically say nothing important at all. The act of doing that can be very important in and of itself. Maybe the content of what you're saying is not, because it has the capacity for letting people just acknowledge that we're sharing something together as we are in this place together. We're not living by ourselves, that, you know, we are sharing an experience, and it doesn't always have to be happy. Like, it can be sharing something that's painful, that really makes you feel a part of something, and that enriches both of your lives without that person becoming your best friend. That kind of really casual talk was important to so many of my tour guides. But then sometimes it also evolved into, you know, much bigger kinds of talk. We have a lot of big things to talk about in the world and with each other, and endless amounts of crises and ways that we are divided. You cannot just have that conversation. You kind of need to practice what it is to talk with other people at a very low stakes kind of level in these kind of very everyday sorts of places where you meet strangers. Because if you're never really practicing it, it's very hard to have the big conversation. At the same time, there are certainly other kinds of talk as well. There are also much more deep dialogues and places that really facilitated a much deeper kind of connection. There is this sort of back and forth of those two kinds of talk. And both of them are really, really sustaining, but in different ways.
Right. You have a great story in your book, because your book has portfolios of photos and then related stories. So I'm wondering if you could read another excerpt from your book related to this casual talk connections.
This one is from Oakland. It's the donut shop, Golden Gate Donuts. It's actually one that sort of talks about bridging those two different kinds of talk. It's called, "We Used to Just Sit There All Day, Telegraph and 42nd Street." I was one of the first Eritrean refugees that came into the United States in the 1980s. And there were lots of organizations to support the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, fighting for independence from Ethiopia. Golden Gate Donut Cafe, we used to sit there all day. I'm not kidding you. When I say all day, I mean all day. There are hardly any people there now, but you know, it's always been like that. Those of us who didn't work on weekends, we'd get in the morning, we'd have donuts, and just sit there, smoke and sit until it's time for the meeting. And at that time, it was not political so much as getting to know other Eritreans, just being friends and starting in this new place. The guys didn't mind us sitting there all day and, you know, filling the place up with smoke. We sat here and this is what we saw. People would come in, buy donuts and coffee and leave, but we just sat there. Actually, people still frequented this long after independence too, but I haven't been there since then. So different places, different buildings have different emotions and different memories. And that is a story from Tuolde in 2006.
This reminds me of a typical Austrian coffee shop where people can sit all day. After their first espresso, they get served little glasses of water endlessly, and nobody tells them to leave.
I always think about it a little bit like some of the places that people took me to, they talked about these amazing people who ran the place and that they really brought people together and, you know, maybe not necessarily in any kind of long-term way, but that they were the kind of person that gave the place its life and all those kinds of things. But I think also of this example too, that the donut shop was kind of like benign neglect. They were like, we're not going to do anything to assist you here, but we will just let you alone and we will let you do what you want. To think that that too is a kind of facilitation where it's not demanding constant exchange. It's not demanding that you paid and you need to leave. I think a lot of these places were like where people could be idle and that was fine. And that idea of doing nothing as being okay, a space to do nothing really could be amazing for a lot of people.
I agree. And it's sort of the home away from home in a way that sort of leads me to my next question, which I think is also fascinating. Where does home start for you? And this can be very different depending on which neighborhood you live in. Your home could be your whole neighborhood, or when you turn the corner, or maybe it's just your own four walls. I'm wondering how people shared this sort of sense of home with you. Where does home start?
When I asked people originally to take me on these tours, I never asked them to take me on a tour of, say, Mosswood or Prospect Heights. I just said, can you give me a tour of your neighborhood? Picking people who generally geographically live near each other. But the tours themselves did not have the same geographical boundaries for different people. That was very interesting to me to see kind of where people felt their sense of place and, you know, my neighborhood, where I feel at home, where that actually was. Sometimes that was close to their houses, and sometimes it was this much more far-flung, more point-to-point sorts of connections that had much more to do with other things maybe than their home per se. People very often would say like, oh, yeah, we're not going to cross here because I feel like that's not part of my neighborhood. I feel at home here, but I don't feel at home over there. I would say, well, why do you feel like that? And a lot of times those boundaries were the sites of red lines where it was like, oh, what are the streets that you don't cross? Well, they're the streets that have been drawn on maps and have been made to be boundaries between neighborhoods for a pretty long time. People could feel those, even though the policies that were enacted were not present anymore. The rules about who can sell to whom on houses, but the impact of that has really shaped our cities. And so people feel those things very, very dramatically, even in their everyday lives, even though they don't always know what that history is that shaped that. People's sense of home also was very much shaped by senses of safety and security. So sometimes people even talked about, a friend of mine was mugged over there, so I actually don't feel like I can go over there anymore, or where they knew about something terrible had happened, especially if it was close to their house, how much that could really interrupt their sense of feeling free or feeling at home or feeling a sense of belonging.
How big home is can shift over time.
Some people were like, I'm a homebody and I really don't go far from my house. And this is, you know, this is my area. It really depended for people.
I would love to ask you to read another quote, which talks about the intense work we all do to actually create places in our city. And I think that's totally true. And it's a beautiful quote.
Sure, I'll read it. So with all this talk about places and the work that they do, we also need to think about the intense work that people do to create and protect places. The housing activists, the community gardeners, the small business owners, the neighbors, the amount of work people do to create the places we inhabit every day is extraordinary. That's a really important piece to always talk about because I think about this as place work, but it's really all the things that create that place. So it's not just the physical place, but it's the people who facilitate that place. People who facilitate that place, their other job is like they make sandwiches, right? Like their job is not facilitator of this place. But I do really see that as being what people are doing. And so really thinking about that work to shape a place. Also the work to preserve places, right? The work for community preservation to make sure that these places still exist and that maybe the housing is affordable enough that people can stay in these neighborhoods. all of that work is part and parcel that allows these places to survive and allows them to do this important work for us. All of that is through the work of people making those places themselves.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Professor Claire Cooper-Marcus, who was one of the first ones in the field of environmental psychology, asks, did you interview people of different minority groups and very different ages?
Yes, absolutely. So both places, there is a pretty wide range of age and background. As in qualitative research, there weren't hundreds of people, but I really did try to get as much of a variety of not just age and race and obviously gender, but also to think about class as well, because I think it's a really important piece of this too. So really to think about all the kinds of diversity of these places, also to look at both neighborhoods and to think about what are some of the important places in the neighborhoods. Am I getting to talk to people connected to those places? And if not, how can I? Particularly in Brooklyn, there was a storefront church, and I thought, I really need to make sure I'm talking to somebody for whom that's an important part of their lives and their families. It was important to me to talk to older people, but also to talk with younger people like teenagers, to have a wide breadth of experience, to talk with people who had immigrated to this country, like Toolde, or to talk to people whose families were rooted in this country, like Lois and Marty in Oakland, both grew up in the neighborhood, and both really spoke a lot to the Black experience in Oakland and to thinking about cultural experiences of the neighborhood, also cultural connections that connected California to the South through the Great Migration, through people they knew. And hearing all of those things, obviously it's very important to have a diverse group of people that you talk to for all the important reasons, but also because otherwise, A, it's really boring, but B, geography really matters. And thinking about these really diverse experiences of place and also diversity of connection to other places seemed really important in the work.
Thank you, Gabrielle. Rachel asks, can you tell us about some of the places people took you to, the places they felt were important to them? Some examples.
Supermarkets. People kept taking me to supermarkets, which I will say was somewhat surprising. But then I was like, oh, this is great. I love this supermarket. And you could really see how the people who ran these supermarkets really welcomed people, and that became an important space for a sense of place and feeling belonging. So supermarkets, parks, libraries, also diners. Yeah, just kind of a wide range of very everyday places. A man in Brooklyn took me to his friend's electronics store, where he and a group of other West Indian men would have lunch every Thursday in the back of the store. And also people just took me on walks, I will say. Some people took me nowhere. They just walked. I shouldn't say they took me nowhere. They took me on the street, and that being out in public and being on the street was a very important space to occupy.
You should read the book. It's full of great places. You inspired me also, Gabrielle, to take people on a tour of my neighborhood, because I think part of this is also to see your own neighborhood with new eyes. When you show it, it's like you have a visitor from out of town, but you could take a friend and rediscover it. That was really inspiring in your book and a way to connect generations. Roxanne's comment and question about the different way people experience walking in a city. She said, thank you for taking the discussion in this direction. Have you noticed any gender differences in how place is experienced, particularly with respect to freedom? How does safety factor in?
From my own experience and from my own perspective, walking is something that's super important to me, but has never felt particularly free. It has always felt like something I needed to insist on. That is the experience of pretty much every woman, I think, in the world, of thinking about safety in public. That made me always feel like I need to insist on my right to be here. But that doesn't make an easy walk all the time. That's important. to talk about and to think about. People that I did walk with, some people were like, I don't think you should come by yourself, or don't come here at night, or things like that. One of my tour guides is a young woman, and she was also very cautious about, you know, where she would walk and where she would not walk and what time she would walk on which block. We talked in a very detailed way about that. One of the neighborhoods, there was a woman who was murdered. What happened had a huge impact on where people felt safe. And especially because it was on a block that I think a lot of people would have said, oh, that's a very safe block. So really thinking about how that shifted people's senses of safety in the neighborhood, how long the impact of that was pretty significant. So certainly gender played a huge role. It's not like people said, oh, I don't go anywhere. It was just like that was always a subtext to the walks. Similarly, race was always a part of people's discussion of their walks and how they felt they either belonged or where they felt that they were safe or unsafe. Those things were always top of mind. So those were definitely parts of what people talked about. And I think also were things that came up because they were showing it to somebody else and sort of explaining to someone else, like why you were making these choices of where you cross the street or where you go or don't go. For some people, they were like, oh, wow, I just really do a lot of this stuff very unconsciously. And if I wasn't showing it to you, I never really would think about exactly why. I know why, but I don't really think about it.
Judy asks or is curious about if casual connections happened across age groups, casual banter and conversations, if you observed that.
That seems to be the kinds of places where this happens the most strongly, or where I feel like it's doing the most place work, not just across generations, but across difference, across all kinds of difference. Those seem to be the places, A, that people talked about and felt incredibly passionate about, and B, when I think about them and I think about the roles that they were playing, I can see how powerful an amount of work those places were doing. There are certainly other places in the neighborhood, not like they're terrible places, but those kinds of connections weren't happening, especially intergenerational connections. Those places where intergenerational connections do happen, they're very, very special and are really important and really do feel like a central thing for neighborhoods. This is not in my book because this is just from my own current neighborhood. There was a diner in my neighborhood, which closed during the pandemic. But that was really one of the few places that I had found here that really cut across a lot of those lines. Age, gender, racial, class lines. When that place closed, a huge hole really opened up in the neighborhood. And I realized how many people I know in the neighborhood only because of that place. And without it, I would have no reason to know them. I wouldn't say hello to them on the street because I wouldn't know them. To think about how much less rich my life would be without that is pretty significant.
Because of the pandemic, we probably all can tell stories of places, centers of connections in our neighborhood, where there's now a hole, sort of rethink how to connect and make special efforts in this regard. This also relates to Rachel's question. Do you have any advice based on your research for older adults in particular to connect to place in a way that increases their sense of belonging?
It's tricky because in some ways it's like you really do need the place that helps facilitate that. And if you don't have that, it makes it very challenging to find it on your own. There is also this thinking of, well, what would it look like to find a space to spend a little extra time or to be kind of doing nothing in public a little bit more? What would that look like? Are there places in which you feel comfortable or safe or able to do that? You know, are there ways that you can practice talking to strangers? Because I do think that that's such an important thing for all of us, that idea of practice. If it's not practical or it's not easy or it's not essential to our kind of daily life, then it kind of goes by the wayside. And sometimes we forget about it or how important that is until you feel like, I feel really lonely. I feel really isolated. To be in that kind of casual contact with strangers, that might be an important part of feeling more connected to place.
Adrian asks, was there mention of gentrification in either of these neighborhoods?
Yeah, you can hardly get away from it. One of the things that came up very often, both of the neighborhoods had very large development projects that were proposed during the time that I was walking with people, slightly different in scale, but large for both neighborhoods. And so thinking about gentrification, but also large scale development and its role in gentrification, how that was a part of the neighborhood, that became a really huge piece of this. People were saying like, well, what does it mean? What do we stand to lose? How do we think about what affordability is? If they say that there's going to be affordable housing, what does that really mean? Will it really be affordable to our neighborhood? Will that just be an opportunity for rents and housing prices to go up? All of that was kind of a piece of this work. I will say all these walks happened before 2008, right? They happened before subprime mortgage crisis, dot-com booms. They happened before a lot of that stuff that have really, really reshaped kind of housing across the country. All of that have been a part of these neighborhoods too. In Brooklyn, I had started that work in 2001, and I brought it back to the neighborhood in 2015 as a public art and dialogue project because there had been such intense gentrification in the neighborhood and so many of the places that people had taken me to work on. It was really quite startling to me to be there after being away for a while. I realized that a lot of organizers and cultural institutions were trying to kind of get a handle on gentrification and trying to figure out like, how do we even understand what's happening? The scope of this, their speed, and also it's just very startling and shocking when something disappears, but it's hard to track what's actually happened over time. I brought the stories and the photographs back to the neighborhood as a series of guidebooks and tours that I would give. And then as we walked around the neighborhood, other people would read my original tour guide's stories in the locations that they had told me those stories. And that really was a helpful way to help people talk about gentrification, because I think on one hand, it's a very useful term. And on the other hand, like far, far, far too general, because it doesn't really describe A, how it happened, or B, what the impacts are. I think that's really important to do both of those things. And so that was an opportunity to have people be able to hear other people's stories from the not too distant past and help them hold on to what was happening right now. Sometimes when you hear somebody else's story, it unlatches something and enables you to tell yours. It became another tool for neighbors to talk with each other on these walks. So that was really an important way of more deeply thinking about gentrification.
Yeah, this is such a difficult topic. It's difficult for the people who are moving into a neighborhood and the people who have lived there for a long time or people who were displaced. There are all these different memories and emotions and connections. Maybe neighborhood walking tours would be one way to connect these groups. Who knows?
Yeah, that idea of facilitating opportunities for people to talk with each other, that is really, really important and really significant. And I think very often you do need to create a context in which people feel like they can.
We could talk much, much longer because this is really a topic which affects all of us. And I really appreciate your creative approach and opening our eyes to a new way to approach our neighborhood and feel confident that the value we attach to little things in our neighborhood is really there. It's real. Yeah. And it's worth defending these places of connection. Thank you, everybody. And thank you, especially Gabrielle. We'll see you next time.
This was really fun. Thank you for such great questions.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. Thank you to our sponsor, the Walnut Foundation, a San Francisco family foundation. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.